We ought not get so enamored with the possibilities and the upsides to not recognize the downsides.
Welcome to Act in Line, a product of the Acton Institute for the Study of Religion and Liberty. I'm Eric Cohn, executive producer. Many Christian congregations now offer hybrid worship services. You can worship in person or online from home. While these options have become extensive, our understanding of them has not kept pace. Furthermore, emerging technologies like artificial intelligence will only further complicate matters. The contemporary church needs a way to make sense of the dizzying influx of emerging technologies, practices, and possibilities. In this episode, Dan Churchwell, Acton's Director of Programs and Education, talks with Trevor Sutton, Senior Pastor of St. Luke Lutheran Church in Lansing, Michigan, about a digital ecclesiology framework for addressing questions about the church in a digital age. You can find additional resources in the show notes for this episode, as well as find previous episodes of Act in Line on our website at acton.org/actinline. And if you like this program, you can help us reach even more listeners by sharing it with a friend and leaving us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. We welcome your comments as well. Act in Line is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
Reverend A. Trevor Sutton is senior pastor of St. Luke Lutheran Church in Lansing, Michigan. He earned his PhD from Concordia Seminary in St. Louis and holds a master's degree in writing, rhetoric, and American culture from Michigan State University. Sutton has written several books, including Redeeming Technology, co-authored with Brian Smith, and Authentic Christianity, co-authored with Jean Edward Veith. He also writes frequently in magazines and journals about issues related to technology, including Christianity Today, Duke Divinity School Journal, and Acton's own Religion and Liberty. He also speaks frequently about technology and the church in a digital age. Well, Trevor, welcome to Act in Line.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. It was such a delight to have you here for our Acton Lecture Series a few weeks ago. Tell me, a little bit about, your specialty. You're a pastor in the Lutheran Church, newly minted PhD. I first came across your name 2 years ago when I was asked to do a review of your book. And so I just really have appreciated getting to know you. What was the gateway into your interest into technology studies or, your current mode of and focus on technology?
I stumbled on it in a really profound way. Stumbled on it, wasn't looking for an interest in technology. So like you mentioned, a parish pastor, and we're just in the shadows of Michigan State University. And so many of my people have a connection to Michigan State. When it came time for continuing education and so forth, I've loved the academy. I love learning. Trying to find what would I study if I were to study there. And I found a program that they had. It was called Digital Rhetoric. Digital rhetoric and professional writing. And I was an English major in undergrad, and I've always had an interest in literature and writing. And so I kind of came to that program really for the professional writing side. And the digital rhetoric was sort of like, I don't know what that is, but okay, whatever.
Like an add-on.
Yeah. So I was really interested in the writing aspect of it. And the digital rhetoric side was, I don't know what that is, but I'll figure it out. And when I got into it, finding out what that was, digital rhetoric is really just exploring how does digital media influence our discourse and our communication, and how what happens when writing is mediated, through digital means. And suddenly it was kind of like the scales fell off, and I'm like, whoa, everything we do discursively, all of our communication, it's somehow digitally mediated. Mm-hmm. Like, not all of it, but so much of it. And we live in this kind of hybridized world where we have unmediated discourse with people, but we also have media discourse, and we're flipping from that constantly throughout the day, texting a friend, meeting with them for coffee, sending them an email later on. And same person, same relationship, but different discourse. Yeah. And so I didn't mean to find an interest in it. And again, I kind of came for B and found A,
yeah.
But it was really eye-opening. And then suddenly that opened my eyes to connecting technology to theology and the life of the church and flourishing more broadly and things like that. And so that's, I didn't wake up one day like, I'm going to study technology. Yeah. It was really finding something that led me on a trail to find other insights.
So in your coursework, was there, you know, when this was starting to emerge, was there a gateway drug, like an idea or a class or a person that had been, you know, was there one or two things that kind of awakened, or was it just generally across the program?
Yeah, a gateway drug. I like that. What got me hooked?
Yeah.
I think it was twofold. It was, one of them was recognizing social media is a thing that can be studied as discourse. And the communication we have there, like there is actually rhetoric involved in social media. I think we realize that like on a visceral level, just like, oh yeah, it's bombastic rhetoric and you know that like, but I'm saying like, no, actually there is a rhetorical elements to it, and there's a visual dimension and a visual rhetoric to social media and the user architecture, the user experience influences how we come at this. So one of the gateways was, wow, this thing that's everywhere can actually be studied. Hmm. And we can have a conversation, not just about it on a surface level, but yeah, what is it doing to us? What is it doing to our communication? What is it doing to our communities? And so seeing this thing that's was so ubiquitous and just all over, but like that can actually be studied. So that was kind of one of the gateways. And then I think the other one was I got really hooked on philosophy of technology, and that there are thinkers that when we come to understand their work and their frameworks and their argumentation, we become better users of technology, better understanding of it, but a better interaction with it. And that really, again, I wasn't really looking for it, but when I found it, it was just, it clicked.
It clicked, yeah. Let's dig into that in a minute a little more. But I mean, let's just start, you know, there's many people when we say technology, I've found in our, you and I share this affinity, right? We both love and talk and speak on these topics and of technology and AI. And it's so wide ranging. Where, like technology, when we talk about it, you just mentioned that rhetoric, you know, in digital technology. But I think a lot of people, when we say technology, think digital technology.
Sure.
Let's back up for a second and let's just talk about technology proper. I mean, how would you, in your own words, or you know, if you refer to somebody, whatever, the idea of what is technology?
Yeah, defining our terms, right?
Yeah.
And I just like you're saying, I find so often we have a functional definition and then we use that functional definition without any assessment of it. Mm-hmm. And then we categorize things as technological or not technological and whatever else. And so, yeah, it's a great place to start. One that I like to go to just because it's memorable, but Langdon Winner, he talks about modern practical artifice. And I just like it because it's three words.
Right.
You know, modern. And what when he says modern, he's not saying that that's the only thing that's technology, but I do think there's a sense in which new things capture our attention more than old things. And so when a modern technology makes us aware of existing technologies and how they're maybe going to be obsolete or there's issues with them, and then the modern iteration of it is filled with promise. So I think there is a sense in which, yes, we should think of modern things, but not only modern things. So I think there's that. And under that idea, what I often like to tell people is it's modern, but not only modern stuff. Mm-hmm. And so what counts as technology would be roads. It would be pens and paper. And then not only is it the physical things, but it's also other thinkers have helped me realize that it's technique.
Yeah.
And so technology is not just artifice and the things that we hold in our hands, but it's actually the technique we have in our brains. And so you could say that like pens and roads and so forth are technology, but so is like bread making.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a technique involved in that. And somehow that's connected to this conversation. So modern, practical, you know, the sense in which technology, kind of understood, is always instrumental in that it's not intended to be a means, like the end itself, but it's always enabling you to do something else. And I don't know if we always get that right exactly. Sometimes I feel like, you know, smartphones, like they become an end in themselves.
Mm-hmm.
We maybe have a bad relationship with it. But generally speaking, it is a tool to enable you to do something else. And so the practicality of it, it enables something to be done. And then artifice, and I think that's helpful in that we don't understand technology if we don't understand that it's designed and made. And somebody has imported intentionality, design, architecture, all of it into this thing. And it didn't just come from nowhere, but it came from somewhere, someone. And that's rhetorical. Like there's intention and persuasion in that. But then we as users have intention and can push against it. So it's, I like those three words as just a jumping off point of you can get to every direction in the conversation in some way from there.
And people, I think when we talk about digital technology and people just defer to digital, I mean, we forget that. I mean, one of the first things we do in the morning generally, you know, we get up, we flip on the lights, we flush the toilet,
yep.
The technologies of sewers, the technology, and then we get in our cars and drive on concrete. And the technology, you know, there's some argument.
But the only thing we focus on is I look at my phone.
Yeah, the flashy things, yep. But the technology, the musical instruments are, you know, we play or our children play.
Well, and that's where sometimes I like to push people a little bit when they, and you and I have talked about this in other places, but when they say I have a techno-pessimistic view, a low view of technology, it's sort of, I kind of push them a little bit in the sense of like, maybe you're techno-pessimistic on some technologies, but not all, because of all these things, you know, that you do seem to appreciate the electricity and, you know, the roof over your head and the language that we use. And clearly that's, you know, Walter Ong talks about that as a technology.
Yes.
And so that, yeah, and that's not to say it's all great. Mm-hmm. There's consequences and problems in it, but it is, I always like to push people a little bit of like, you know, like sometimes people say, like, our church doesn't like technology. I'm like,
yeah.
I don't know. You got a hymnody
and
codex books. And
it always takes a few defining questions.
A little bit, yeah. What kind of technology do you not like? And again, that's not to nettle people, but I think what I'm passionate about is people having a more thoughtful grasp of what they're talking about, what they're accepting, what they're rejecting, and just knowing why they're doing that.
Helpful distinctions.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, yeah. And I mean, at Acton, you know, we talk a lot about economics and entrepreneurship, globalization. I mean, one of the best books, I mean, it sounds boring, but it's called The Box, you know, Levinson's book, The Box, on the invention of the 40-foot ocean-going steel container. You know, and the ships that were able to, you know, in the post-1950s, globalization couldn't have happened without the box. And so, yeah, those are, and even, I mean, there's some authors and, you know, writers that are thinkers that are thinking about that technique, democracy. They'll argue democracy is a technique, is a way of looking at the world and
sure.
a technology of getting people together. So yeah, it's very wide ranging. Even today we might narrow it maybe more to digital technology.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what's neat is all of those things that you've talked about, they drift into the background of our consciousness, and we don't even think of them as technology,
yep.
but they have such a profound impact on the world. And I think because of that, like they're easily overlooked and dismissed, but the implications and the import of them is so profound. Mm-hmm. And therefore, they are really worthy of discussion and inquiry.
Absolutely.
Because they are profoundly shaping society
yep.
and our interactions.
And it's and I try to encourage people that, you know, either I mean, it seems like everybody's interested to some degree on digital technology, but starting to think once you have a conversation with someone to figure out what they're interested in, quickly you can refer them or engage them in some sort of technological conversation because it affects everything we do. I've been fascinated lately by the quote in the book by David Nye on his assertion that technological progress is Americans' civil religion. That worship what America, you know, is primarily, you know, and it's a bold claim, and the book is fantastic. But What do you think about technological progress as American civil religion? Do you think it's unique to America, or you know that concept?
That's a great quote, and there's a lot to chew on with that. I have a few thoughts on it. One thing that was interesting is this past summer I was in Africa teaching on technology, mm-hmm. and I had some degree of trepidation of I'm going to go to South Africa and talking about the internet, where it's so ubiquitous in one place and access to it is a little harder to come by in a developing country and developing places. But it was interesting how what did we have most in common was technology, like digital, like smartphones. And so the languages are different, culture, customs, food, all of these things are different. But we talk about WhatsApp and a smartphone, like we get it. We're on the same language. So there is an absolute sense in which this has been imported to the whole world. Now, the question of religion and this being a salvific thing in some way, one that I've found really helpful, I stumbled on him in my PhD work, was Egbert Sherman. And what he really helped me understand is that talking about technology quickly gets us in the realm of religion because we're talking about what he says, like these are radical things, and by radical, like the roots and like fundamental, ultimate things. And what I found was really helpful with him is that absolute techno-optimism becomes religious, as does absolute techno-pessimism becomes religious. And this isn't exactly what he says, but kind of filtering it through my work, that if your greatest, as a Lutheran pastor, Martin Luther talks about the first commandment, whatever you fear, love, and trust in above all else, like that's your God. And so this idea that you can fear above all else technology and this like ultimate techno-pessimism of it is going to destroy us. That's in some way become a god in the sense of like your ultimate fear, the ultimate power, you might say, in the world is that. So you can turn it into a religious thing negatively, but then also if your greatest love or your greatest trust is technology, then that can become your god. And so what I really like about Sherman is it's not just like people who are enamored with this turn it into a religion. And it's not just people who are hesitant of it or avoidant of it turn it into a religion, but like on both ends of that extreme, it can become religious. And if your ultimate fear or hope is technology, you've got a God.
yeah. No, that really is. And it seems like what Nye argues is some of that's uniquely American or emerged from American ethos that is fascinating. But you're
interesting. And I think Industrial Revolution then imported and magnified maybe in the United States for sure.
Absolutely. And the Africa example you used having, they're called the leapfrog generation. There's not very many laptops in Africa. They primarily went straight to the phone, the smartphone. And so what let's pivot just for a second. Well, since you brought it up, let's it's fun. You have questions written out, but it's where our conversation goes. I love it. You've talked about techno-optimism, techno-pessimism. Can you just kind of break that fulcrum down just a little bit?
Yeah, I find it, to me at least, it's helpful to have broad, what would you call it, broad categories to kind of orient different thinkers as you're just talking to people, some kind of a framework, and not letting that framework be, not forcing everything to conform to that, but techno-optimism or techno-pessimism. Techno-pessimism says that it's a generally lower view of the possibilities and promises and good things that can come from technology. So a lot of times that comes with a view that technology imprisons or forces you to work within certain confines. And that's kind of another category I like to sometimes think in terms of is sort of user agency. Do you have any user agency in technology, or does it really just control what you can do, how you can do it, when you can do it, or do you have maximal agency and do whatever you want? And that's a big conversation in philosophy of technology. And ordinary people, you know, do technologies have values, and do they impose those on you, or are they just neutral things that you come and put that on it?
Indeed, yeah.
Yeah, and that's a huge question, and that's where I like the idea of are you pessimistic about what technology does to us? Thinkers like that would be someone like Martin Heidegger, kind of classically techno-pessimistic. Jacques Ellul is one of those, mm-hmm. or Lewis Mumford to a lesser degree. But this idea that on the whole, these things are deleterious and harmful to individuals, societies, people, that kind of thing. You know, Heidegger kind of says like, you can't help but see the world through these technological things. And yeah. So the whole world just reveals itself like that. And if all you've got is a hammer, everything's a nail and you got to hit it. And you know, that kind of thing. Then on the other side, techno-optimism, you know, that's sort of like Francis Bacon would be a good example of that. I think in some way, maybe someone like Elon Musk mm-hmm. kind of embodies that sort of thing of if we just progress enough, if we just sort out the problems and get the kinks all ironed out, like this will be our saving thing and the thing that ultimately makes us better, keeps us alive longer, you know, that sort of thing. And so what I find is helpful is to orient ourselves in relation to that conversation and question and listen to those different voices, but recognize they are coming from different extremes.
Yeah. What do you think the visceral for a lot of people? I mean, there are a lot of people on the techno-optimism side as well. But, you know, a lot of science fiction, right? You know, post-World War II, you read. And then the movies coming out in the late 70s, 80s, you know, about tech, obviously the Terminator movies are what many people think of initially. What do you think just is like almost gut visceral? Yeah, if AI or, you know, the robots become sentient, we're all going to die. Like, why do you think that's so popular?
Yeah. Yeah. Why is that so popular? I think it captures our fear. Right. And fear is a visceral feeling. And I think it captures our fear. I think it's in the realm of possibility because you see enough of the kindling there for it. So it's not science fiction is captivating because it's not so far out there, but it is conceivable.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we've actually found with a lot of sci-fi things that, you know, what sounds like sci-fi, like, oh, give it 30, 40 years, and like, there you go.
Yeah.
You've got it. Not all science fiction things, but many of them. And so I think it captures our fear. It's conceivable, but often the distance and that sort of thing. I think the other thing, here's kind of my broad take on it, and in the lecture I was talking a little bit about this, that generally what I find is the short-term fears tend to be overblown. But the long-term transformation tends to be underestimated.
Yeah, that's Amara's law.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, Roy Amara.
Yeah, and just this idea that when things like AI, and that's, I mean, in popular discourse, it captures our attention and it gets headlines and it gets readers and eyes. And it's not to say that it's totally bunk, but I think the timeline tends to be concentrated and truncated. Like you read about this on Monday and Tuesday, the world's going to melt down.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's conceivable, it's possible, but at the same time, the slow, steady, kind of like insidious nature of it, just you don't realize when you finally get there.
Yeah.
And to me, that's actually more dangerous in some way, because you find yourself so far afoot and so far off course, but you didn't even know how you got there.
And the techno-pessimism and optimism is obviously a spectrum. Mm-hmm. You're not like one or the other, right? Yep. You know, people kind of lean, if you will, one way or the other sometimes. And on the techno-optimist side, what do you see as some of the, you know, why are people, you know, pejoratively, you know, the tech bros, you know, that kind of idea. Like, why is Silicon Valley and other, you know, why Jensen Huang at NVIDIA, you know, he was just on, you know, made major news 2 weeks ago. at the Saudi Arabian Technological Conference, and you know are worshipped. You know, they were the techno optimists. Everything is possible. Chip strength and all of the, you know, almost, you know, can we upload our consciousness at the very, you know, furthest end? Why do you think the techno optimism, though, on the equally opposite side is so empowering or interesting to a lot of people?
I think in some way, I mean, Elon Musk has spoken in these terms about, you know, he sees techno optimists and technological progress as, you know, he's talked about it as like magic. Mm-hmm. And it is this sense in which he's not entirely wrong in the sense of what technological progress enables us to do. It seems like magic. If you take it back 50 years, here's a great, just imagine this, that, and I don't have the firm numbers, historical dates, but the Wright brothers and Kitty Hawk.
Oh, yeah.
And they flew like 15 seconds, right?
Yep.
And then I think it's like 60 years. We have a man on the moon.
Yeah. I think it was 50. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
But it's bonkers to think like, hey, can we fly? Can we fly over this hill? Can we do it for 15 seconds and not die? Like, and then in such a short amount of time to be able to not only fly, but, you know, into outer space. And so I think we would be wrong to deny something real and captivating and awe-inspiring and wonderful in mm-hmm. techno-optimistic thing. And it's not like people are dopes for believing that.
Yeah.
And in some way, like rightfully so. But I guess where I come at it is we ought not get so enamored with the possibilities and the upsides to not recognize the downsides. Mm-hmm. And so this idea, you know, I try to be as median as I can on the pessimism and optimism, probably a little pessimistic of center, just in the fact that I think we need more brakes, that we need gas. And so that's kind of where I land on a lot of things. But I think there's this sense in which technology always makes some things easier and other things harder. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite lines, Wendell Berry, not one who does a lot with technology, but kind of a techno curmudgeon, you might say.
Right.
but he says something about, you know, we've mapped the human genome and we know like every nook and cranny of the you know, our DNA, but a lot of people don't know where their children are and they don't have a relationship with them. And his point's sort of like, yeah, we've soared to these amazing heights, but have we progressed as a family that loves each other?
Yeah. It's a certain kind of progress, maybe small p progress, but a lot of people articulate it as capital P progress, like everything is progressing. A quote that centers me on this topic is Paul Virilio, the Italian philosopher. You know, he argues with the invention of the ship, you had the invention of the shipwreck.
Yep.
With the invention of the plane, you had the invention of the plane crash. With the invention of electricity, you have the invention of electrocution. The negativity of any technology is therein.
Well, that, and then you can take that even further with this idea that it creates those problems you're talking about. And what is like technological progress? Well, mitigating those problems. Mm-hmm. And so like, you can't find your children? Like, we have an app for that. Like, yep. We can help.
Yeah, AirTag them.
Yeah, exactly. And at some point, we need to stop and ask the question of, is the progress and the problems and the solutions that come from the progress and the problems, is it capital P progress?
Mm-hmm. And there's a philosophy, you know, to take it back to raw, you know, or theological or philosophical terms, this idea of embodied or embedded in it, like who we are as human persons, whether we want to talk theologically about, you know, Christ, why was the incarnation so important for Christ to come bodily, all the way just philosophically, what does it mean to be a human person and engage in conversation with other embodied soul, you know, that and some, I mean, that's becoming, you know, David Gunkel and others writing on robot rights and that kind of, you know, they're saying those conversations don't even, I mean, they're not interested in any of those conversations anymore. And I think there's going to be a section of thinkers that are taking the Gunkel route. But for the vast majority of religiously minded people, I mean, being embodied, being a human person is very, very essential to what it means to be in communion with God, to be in communion with one another. So how do you, you know, how have you thought, you know, through that, some of those, and I know you talk a lot about digital ecclesiology, which, you know, the study of digital information within the church and the church context, but how about anthropology? You know, even I would argue maybe even a little more basic.
Oh, yeah. And I don't know that we can really answer all the ecclesiological questions without the anthropological questions, because the church is also people, right?
Yeah.
And I think what's interesting, just as you were kind of laying that all out, it's easier to answer those questions when it's humans and robots. It's a little harder when you're talking about things like neural implants, mm-hmm. where suddenly transhumanism went from sort of sci-fi, like, oh, imagine this, you know, uploading your consciousness to, we're doing human clinical trials on this.
Yeah.
And it's maybe not the full-fledged thing. But so I think in that sense, I would say that, yeah, Marshall McLuhan talks about media this way, and he's got his laws. And it is interesting where he says that new media always retrieves something that was maybe taken for granted or neglected or forgotten about. Mm-hmm. And I think your question is exactly right, that new media and new technology and the realization of transhumanism in a lot of ways, what it's retrieving is the basic question of the humanities, the liberal arts, the basic question of very classical things. What does it mean to be human? What does it mean to flourish as a human? And I guess my point would be, as anthropology gets murky and eroded with new technologies, now is the time more than ever to like reassert that and reestablish that. Mm-hmm. And so, like you said, there's all these resources, theological resources, the incarnation. Like, God didn't upload salvation. God didn't send a, disincarnated word or something like that, but God came and dwelt among us. Eugene Peterson in the Message translation, he talks about, God moved into the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And just like this, you know, captivating kind of like, wow, God's present and near. And so drawing on those resources, I think drawing on the other resources of what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to be fully human? What does it mean to flourish as a human? I think in some way those things are gaining, they've always been relevant, but they're more relevant now more than ever because of the things that you're talking about.
Yeah. On the date of this recording, we are 4 years exactly and a day, you know, D-Day plus one, of the COVID lockdown. And a good question that came up after your lecture was regarding, you know, evangelicals, and your lecture was largely on church in a digital age or this digital ecclesiology. And one of the questions was, you know, primarily Protestants. There were Catholics as well, Fulton Sheen and others, but that Protestants really have captured technology the moment it came out. They figured out how to utilize it, you know, whether it was, telegraphy, you know, the telegraph versus, and then to radio, and then obviously television ministries. And then now, talk a little bit about, you know, this human anthropology, this embeddedness. There are some, you know, that I know several. I have good friends actually that are kind of leading some of these engagements, but they want to do online church. They see this is the future, and you know they even talk about like digital baptisms or digital communion.
Yeah.
And tell me what are your thoughts? You're an ordained pastor in the Lutheran Church. You have a PhD, and you know you have a very practical side of your work. You engage in this every day on the ground, if you will. But you've studied deeply. I mean, generally, what are your thoughts on? I mean, can you take part in the Eucharist, you know, digitally?
Yeah, it's a phenomenal question. I'm going to take us deep into the weeds of Scripture. I think in some way, what I see with all those things you're describing, so going full-fledged into mediated community, online community, mediated baptism, online, you know, virtual baptism, all of that, what media does, like at its core, is it extends. And it extends in the sense of like you can be in a place but not fully in a place, and you can extend your voice or your face or your words through that media, through a distance. And so that extension comes also, in my mind, with the ability to hide. And what I mean is like revealing part of you, but not all of you. And so we're recording this in person. Mm-hmm. And like, I don't know, if I smell, like, you can smell me. Right. And I can't hide that. But those listening, like, I can hide that. Yeah. And it's not extended. And so there's that sense. And it takes me in some way, just as you were asking the question, to Genesis and Adam and Eve in sin. What's their first instinct? To hide. And God says, where are you? And like, so God's seeking them out. And what are they doing? They're hiding from God, but then also hiding themselves with fig leaves. And so I think there is a sense in which media, and I think we learned this in the pandemic, we find an upside to it because it lets us engage on our terms. It lets us, you know, turn off the Zoom and look at that. I'm in my living room. Mm-hmm. That's kind of nice, you know. But then I think there's this whole other sense in which you can perfectly curate your background so that the Zoom experience looks like my house is perfect. And I mean, I'm guilty of this, like doing Zoom meetings, like I'm going to arrange it so the clutter's not seen, you know. And the same thing when it comes to digital correspondence with people. In person, if someone asks you a hard question, you're invited to answer it there, and it's hard. But if it's an email that you don't want to answer right away, like you can sit on it for several days. You can delete it. And the ability to hide from one another is it seems good and beneficial, but it also, I think, in some way takes us back to Genesis 3 and sin and maybe some fundamental brokenness in us.
So how have you engaged the idea of like digital communion or digital baptism? Are you, when that came up, you know, it accelerated, the conversation about it anyways accelerated during COVID, you know, 2020, et cetera. But how have you focused on that at all, or if at all?
Our church body wrestled with some of those questions. And the good thing or the bad thing about, you know, kind of being one that studies this is a lot of eyes turned to me and said, help us figure this out. What I found was hard in that is, you know, us as a confessional church that we draw on our historic confessions of faith, the Book of Concord for Lutherans, that wasn't a question, right? And so this idea of digital worship and online worship and all that stuff, like you can go through all of it and like you're not going to find an answer.
Sure.
And so you have to then do this thing that's, I think, somewhat challenging to glean the wisdom you can and the insights you can from that, but glean it into new situations. And so that's a challenge, is you can go through all of Scripture, and this is pretty obvious, but all of Scripture, you're not going to find that answer. You can go through all of, you know, many different church traditions, especially if they're historically confessional, looking back at something from a time ago. You know, Catholicism is different. You have someone who speaks more authoritatively in the present.
Right.
But anyway, so there's this idea that it is challenging. What we've ultimately, our church, my congregation, but also our church body, it sounds really ordinary and basic, but the idea of like, even if you can, you shouldn't. There's wisdom in that. But then what we've even kind of further understood is it is incongruent with the heart of the things themselves. And if the heart of baptism or the Lord's Supper, obviously different traditions are going to have somewhat different views on it. But think about it. I mean, it is earthy, the elements that are connected to this. And so to the most extreme, to digitize the water of baptism.
Mm-hmm.
There's a ephemeral sense of that, like, where is the water? Is it water? Did it go away? And so I think these things that are meant to be communal and physical and earthy and for the certainty of who we are and the promises of God, it erodes all of those. And so in that sense, it's kind of a non-starter sort of thing of like, even if you could, it would be contrary to all of it. even if the technology enables us to do this thing, it is so at odds with what it's supposed to do.
Keeping in that same vein, you know, how do you help your people? I mean, in during the pandemic, I mean, you mentioned several things in your talk that, you know, this digital ecclesiology, like there were several groups that would watch online. You know, what are some ways that you've used positively some of the digital advancements, you know, in the again, the acceleration of the advancements in the past 4 years?
And that's the thing. I never want somebody to hear me and say, boy, that guy really, you know, is not keen on technology. Because I think I'll be heard wrong if that's how people perceive it. But I hope, and for the life of the church, and even more broadly, even, you know, the Acton Institute, is to how do we go full bore on the best things of technology and use those, and then have the wisdom to say, but here's what it can't do, and here's what we shouldn't do with it. And so, you know, one of the things that we've found, these are low level things, but as a church, we found Zoom for Zoom meetings great for conveying information in real time to a group of 5 or 10 people. So our staff, we have 2 campuses and things like that. And there's times where we will all get on Zoom, quick 15-minute meeting, and we get to see each other. But it's largely, you know, me as the senior pastor communicating, here's this, here's that, this I think. Any questions, any comments? Okay, cool. What we found Zoom is not good for is relationship building. And fellowship and being together. And, you know, there's times where we had tried it, but it just failed miserably for that. And so knowing what tools accomplish what ends and using them toward that and not trying to use tools that are ill-fitted for the wrong thing. So I think that's one of the things we've done. Another thing that I don't think were it for not for the pandemic, we wouldn't be doing it, but we do, you know, a podcast sort of thing. And we don't do it all the time, but we find it's a great way to engage our people in a conversation that doesn't seem like a right fit for the worship service, doesn't really fit for the announcements, doesn't make sense for a Bible study or something like that. But we want to talk about this thing in a long form way of 20, 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, we found it to be infinitely helpful because it's more engaging than a long email. It's more engaging than a newsletter. We have fun doing it. And so, yeah, I think that's the thing that the church, but even outside the church, having the wisdom and discernment to say, what can this help me do well? But not just blindly saying like, sweet,
yeah,
shiny, new, let's do it.
Yeah, I think there's something, you're right. You know, that discernment I think is huge on what these tools are doing. And you use the term tool in your talk. You know, you've shared the famous quote, you know, we shape our tools and then our tools shape us. And in the same vein of the evangelical or the Protestants really being hyper, in the best sense, innovative, you know, one of the brand new things that I found interesting just to follow is Pulpit AI.
Okay.
And Pulpit AI is a group that have started, you know, and I think they claim they already have 2,000 pastors and hundreds of churches signing up. But it's an AI platform that they're arguing and teaching pastors. I think it's eventually going to be a pay platform. But how to create brands around that they can upload their sermons and then the AI will chop it into bits that you can then throw on TikTok and throw, you know what I mean? It's following those venues, you know, so it's called Pulpit AI and it's becoming quite a thing in a certain sector. Are there habits, you know, just thinking, put on your pastoral hat, habits that, you know, you would want to offload to some sort of ChatGPT or AI, you know, AI-infused system? Or, you know, coming back to discernment, are there ways, is this holy bad, holy good? Those are too binary, you know, but what do you think of that idea of a Pulpit AI system?
Yeah, so that thing as a whole, I see some problems, but not knowing exactly what all.
Sure,
I mean,
hearing
what you're saying, but some examples would be this: like our congregation, we have 2 campuses. We have services in English, Arabic, and Swahili.
Wow!
And we have community, you know, people that are primarily Swahili speaking or Arabic speaking. We have pastors that lead those communities, But for instance, we use, and this isn't, it's a form of AI and generative AI even at that, but like Google Translate.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so we will take materials that we prepare in English and then run it through that and then have a native speaker of Swahili review it and make sure that we're not saying something that's, you know, totally crazy and that kind of deal. But it saves a whole lot of translational time. And we find that we've been using that for a while. That's a really helpful way to do it. Another thing, I think, you know, image creation and the idea that a small congregation in no way would be able to pay for a graphic designer mm-hmm. and that kind of thing, and to be able to use AI and generative AI as a way to generate an image. I think there's absolutely possibilities in that. And I can see that being beneficial.
So using Midjourney to create your bulletins or something along those lines.
Within reason, I think. Yeah. And the other thing that I think a lot of people maybe this is kind of this obtuse view of it or something like that. But like nobody's going to use generative AI, or hopefully not. Maybe they will. But they shouldn't use generative AI and then never proof it with a human and just send it on out. And so if a smaller congregation is trying to come up with a job posting for, you know, an administrative assistant or something like that, they may not know exactly where to start with that. But to go to some sort of generative AI and type, these are some of the parameters we're looking for, now create this thing. But you're not going to publish that to your congregation without several sets of eyes looking at it and changing it and updating it. And so I think there is a strange binary that we sometimes assume if you're going to use this tool, you're going to completely extricate yourself from it. Mm-hmm. Like that doesn't seem to make sense. But the thing you're talking about with that AI pulpit kind of thing, and I mentioned this briefly in the lecture, and I haven't really, I sense someday I'll write an article on it or something like that, but thinking in terms of rhetoric, you know, logos, ethos, and pathos, and how in persuasion we deploy these different things. I think there's a sense in which what I see emerging is the ethos of the pastor and the community could actually become way more important. And for a long time, we've maybe taken that for granted. And but now you have this thing that like it can do. Logic and organization and data, you know, there's still bugs to iron out. But in some way, like, man, this thing can crank out an itinerary faster than you or I could.
Yeah, the natural language processing is that's fascinating to me, especially in our fields of lecturing, preaching, teaching, you know, these ideas.
And I think so then the logos, like our ability to read and summarize a whole volume of books, humans are better at that. And there's reasons why maybe computers will never be good at that from a logos standpoint. I don't doubt that. But I guess what I'm getting at is maybe the ethos of the lived practitioner espousing this wisdom, maybe that becomes more important. And no matter how great the logos gets, the embodiment, the community, your conduct, your virtues, mm-hmm. Those things that we sort of took for granted, like how much do you know, you know, how persuasive are you, that kind of thing. Maybe that persists, but the other things, the ethos of the person in the community might become more important as those tools become more widespread.
Yeah, that's good. And those tools, I mean, the content, the absolute avalanche of words that's out there. Everybody can be a content producer now. And, you know, Neil Postman was famous. He, standing on the shoulders, obviously, in the foundations of McLuhan and Ong and others, but he helped coin the idea of media ecology, right, a discipline talking about this. But Neil Postman argued that, you know, in the 1450s, you didn't have Europe plus the printing press. You had a whole new Europe. Mm. It changed ecologically. Not just a tool, yeah. You know, and that there's an argument embedded in media ecology that way. And some have argued that, you know, you don't have the internet. Some have used that quote to say, you know, in the 2000s, you don't have the world plus the internet. You have a whole new thing.
Yeah.
And obviously the changes were, I mean, you have the depending on your theological persuasion, right? You have the Protestant Reformation enabled largely by the printing press and other things, and the Counter-Reformation. You know, it just changed literacy rates, et cetera. I mean, it was a major pivotal moment in the world. And it seems to be like we're in one of those right now. Mm. And it's hard to see it when you're in it.
Oh, yeah.
Like we're right, you know, and that's what is Lewis famous for saying, you know, let the clean sea breeze of the past go through our – that's why reading old books is important, you know. And so I think we're in a moment where it's hard for us to discern. That's what, when you say discernment. Mm. It's hard for us really to discern because we're living while the plane's being built in the moment. And what habits do you think are important for – the laymen, the men and women in your congregations and our, you know, in our to be in tune to? Is there one or two habits that you think obviously the habits, et cetera, spiritual disciplines are important, but is there one or two you think that we should pay attention to in this current technological moment?
Absolutely. And I, going to everything you were saying, I think in light of that, fasting or Sabbath rest is, I think, one of the more important habits to discern and to double down on. And what I mean by that is, you know, like addicts sort of like, I can quit whenever I want, right? It's like, okay, we'll do it, you know? And in some sense, I think the spiritual habit and the practice of fasting and Sabbath rest becomes all the more important now. You know, addicts talk about, I can quit whenever I want. It's like, well, okay, do it. And so I think there's a sense in which if we are just inundated with so much technology, there's not room to breathe or discern or think clearly about it, pausing and stopping from it for a period of time is, I think, hugely beneficial. So what I tell people, it's really pragmatic, but do an audit of some sort of technological use. And this is scary, painful stuff, but do an audit in the sense of I'm going to look at how many times I open my phone in a given day. And a lot of smartphones do this for you anyway.
Yeah.
Or, you know, how many times am I – what's my – how long am I on websites that are, you know, media related? How much am I in the news? And just start a stopwatch, end a stopwatch, that sort of thing. And do that for a select period of time, a day, probably longer than that, a week, something like that. And then count all of that, evaluate that, and figure out what you want to – is that appropriate or not? What is that doing to you? Here's a scary thing I sometimes tell people, like ask a trusted friend about, you know, like, hey, tell me a little bit about how focused do I seem to be when I'm with my family? That's a scary. How often am I on my phone?
Now you're meddling.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry. I'm going to ruin a bunch of marriages that way. But yeah, ask, you know, evaluate and maybe ask someone else outside of you about that. And then I think all of that leading to an informed practice of fasting. And so, you know, at different times, what I've done is, and you got to be judicious with this as a pastor, but, you know, even communicating to people and so forth, like from 5 to 8 o'clock, my phone's going to be on airplane mode. Cause that's prime family time, or something like that. And so I think, or this day of the week, I don't engage in this, you know, during the season of Lent, a lot of times people do a social media fast or something. And so I think what I like about the habit of fasting when it comes to technology would be it's exerting your ability to have agency over it and building that habit, building that strength and capacity to not use. And that sort of thing. The other one that I find, it sounds strange, but the more I've thought about it, Albert Borgman talks a bit about this, but the idea of festive celebration. And like, we live in a now culture. We live in a, you know, Instagram culture of like, if we do have festive celebration, it's just for other people to see it.
Performative.
Performative, yeah, yes, exactly. Yes. Yeah. And so small things, but just the idea of like, yeah, inculcating a practice of celebration is really important. And like, my children think I'm crazy for doing it, but I'm just going to keep doubling down. I think they actually like it. But family dinner, kind of a sacred time for our family. And like, we almost always catch family dinner. And, you know, 90% of the week, we're able to do that, or 90% of the time. But I light a candle now. And like, we just have a candle in the center of the table. And, you know, the first time I ever did it, it's like, why are we lighting a candle? And I, family time, special time. And it's just a small way,
sure.
But it's developing this habit of somehow this moment is celebratory and festive in a way that the rest of the day isn't. Mm. And again, really small, but yeah, I think somehow digital technology and devices erode that festive celebration. And so what are the small ways we can be subversive to that?
Yeah, those are good. So we're wrapping up here. I like to, you know, ask people what if you were, you know, for further study or interest, you know, who is animating you or who would you recommend? Yeah, those are two kind of different questions. But what how do you, you know, what are two or three books or Substacks or, you know, where do you, you know, keep animated and invigorated in this topic in your own life?
Here's a fun one. We were talking earlier in this about a definition of technology.
Mm-hmm.
One that I like to tell people is read the Bible with a pretty expansive view of technology. And again, not just like internet, not just smartphones, but anything that is artifice, that is designed, anything that is, you know, brought forth by human invention and creation and all that. And just like, use that as your lens, put those lenses on and then read the Bible. You can just read Genesis. And it's just fascinating where a lot of times I'll challenge people in that because they're sort of like, so you study technology and theology, like what does the Bible say about the internet?
Yeah, right.
Okay, sure. But then you think about the ark. You think about the tabernacle.
That's my favorite. One of my favorites.
You think about the tabernacle and like Bezalel is this guy that's gifted with the spirit. Why? For like craftsmanship. And it's so beautiful. And then beyond that, like the temple and all that stuff. You can even think of, this is crazy, but like the cross. The cross is a violent technology. Mm-hmm. And God's like, I'm going to use that technology of the Roman Empire that's effective at fear and effective at violence and squashing insurrection. I'm going to use that technology for salvation.
Yeah.
Like, it's just incredible. So I think a thing that animates me is what does Scripture say about technology? And that's a fun experiment. To people don't often read it with that hermeneutic.
Right.
And so I think that's a suggestion I would have for people.
That's really good.
Yeah. Another one that I just have found really helpful would be Albert Borgman. He can be a little more academic, but he does have a few texts that are a little bit more popular texts. And what I really like about Borgman, he's into fly fishing and running, so am I. So,
Montana.
Right? Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. So he's captured my attention.
Yes.
But I like him because he does not try. He's clearly techno-pessimistic and has suspicions about it. But he has a really helpful way of how can we retain technology in its best forms, but not let it own us.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about like how do we trim back the overgrowth of technology. And I really love that idea. And like so he'll say something about, you know, he doesn't use this terminology, but the idea of like it's good and okay to use a GPS to get you to a hike. But then it's good to turn that GPS off and not then rely on it the rest of the way.
Yeah.
And I really like his idea of when are devices appropriate and helpful and when do we need to ditch the devices and engage in those focal practices that he talks about. And so I like him because it's not as simple as, yeah, just burn them all. And it's certainly not as simple as like, yep, these are great, you know, but he gives you a, underneath a very robust philosophy, he gives a very practical thing of how to use these things and use them well. So I think reading Scripture through that lens, someone like Albert Borgman. And then also, he's also somewhat difficult to read, but we mentioned Egbert Sherman.
Yeah.
And I found his stuff just very helpful because he's working in the realm of philosophy of technology, but he's doing it theologically inflected. And he's one of the lone voices, as far as I can tell, who speaks into that field, but says, hey guys, there's going to be something missing, fundamentally missing. And you're talking about fundamentally religious things. And so we need to have a theological framework to this conversation. So those are three suggestions I'd have.
That's great. Well, Trevor, it's an absolute delight to have you on the Acton podcast. And thank you for investing in our Acton lecture series and your writing and religion and liberty for us. And we look forward to hearing more from you. So thank you for being here.
This is awesome. We've got so much fun stuff to talk about. It's a joy for me to be part of it.
As always, thank you for listening. Our team loves putting this podcast together for you. It's encouraging to hear from our listeners. Feedback is incredibly important to us because it lets us know what you'd like to hear more of, including the kinds of topics you're interested in most. If you have comments, feedback, or ideas for a show topic or interesting guest, you can email our team at producer@acton.org. Until next week, for Acton Line, I'm Eric Cohn.